I'll be honest with you at the beginning of the message here this morning that I all but invited myself to come down here. I did invite myself to come down here. I knew that Tim was busy. That was one of the reasons. But what else is new? I was also at a point in my own teaching in Duluth that was a good stopping place, and so I thought it just fine to take a break from that. But most importantly, I believe that the Lord would have this for you, particularly. Reading through 1 Peter in my own personal devotions over the summer, I saw it in a way that made complete sense concerning our circumstances as of late. I had you guys in mind when I read it, because even from afar, I'm somewhat aware of the happenings in your church. And when I come to teach here, I always do my best to bring something that you can use, something that will encourage you, challenge you, in the biblical term, edify you. Not that what I'm speaking of this morning doesn't apply to my own church, or churches all over the world, but this is for you. And I want you guys to know that even though I'm a state away, I still think about you. This is Peter's first letter. It's a short letter. We know a lot about him as the author, but we know very little about the elders or the pastors to whom he writes, other than that they had small fellowships that were scattered about various regions in the Roman Empire. At the very beginning of his letter, he lists the places Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia. But we don't know much about these people to whom he writes. We don't know what got these men into the ministry. We don't know what kind of personalities they had. And we don't really know much about their relationship with the Apostle Peter. Neither do we know much of anything about the members of the churches to whom he writes. We don't know when they got saved. We don't know how long they've been saved or how they got saved. We don't know what it was that brought them to their particular church in the first place, right? Because everybody has their own story. Everybody gets to where they are somehow. We don't know a lot about these people. We don't know in what capacity they served there. He addresses the elders particularly, but no doubt there may have been some ministerial staff, some people that were in charge of particular facets of ministry within each of those fellowships. These were a mixed group, but they all loved the Lord and they were all faithful. And what we do know is that Peter was concerned for them. He wants these guys to hear what he has to say. And he wants them to take it to heart. And he starts with the pastors. He says, "The elders who are among you, I exhort. I who am a fellow elder." He's exhorting them. The term there elsewhere in the scriptures is translated to beg or to plead. In other places, it's translated comfort. So from the very beginning here, we see Peter using a very humble approach. He's not in any way being heavy-handed, as he could be if he wanted to, as an apostle. He is by rank above these elders, but he doesn't use that rank to his advantage. And instead of using the authority that was implicit to the position in order to somehow gain their compliance where he has concerns for these churches, he instead uses humility, and he approaches them, if you notice, as a fellow elder. He says, "I'm a fellow elder." Why is Peter doing that? He's approaching them in this way and using all humility because he wants what's best for the church, and he wants what's best for God's people. That makes total sense. That would be the heart of a true apostle, if not also an elder, a pastor. He wants what's best for these people, even if it means losing a little dignity. Is he an apostle? Yeah. Does he need to flaunt that right here in chapter 5? No. He just wants what's best for them. Even if it means taking a step down in how people view him, that's okay. I believe that Peter, under the inspiration of God, and the Bible says clearly that when they wrote, they were under the inspiration of God, so we know that he was. And I believe that under the inspiration of God, Peter knew that something was coming for these ancient churches. I believe that he understood, even if he didn't have all the details, that their health and their future depended upon his being heard and understood right here. And that's what meant most to him. I believe that that's what he really cared about. He has no other agenda. And I would say on a side note here that I also believe that the health and the future of any modern church, just like those 2,000 years ago, depends upon the people in that church hearing what Peter has to say, particularly in chapter 5. And that any church who would overlook or ignore the concerns that Peter expresses here and the wisdom that he offers and the insights that he gives is to really single-handedly invite trouble into your church corporately and also to reduce your chances of survival in that church personally. So it's with this, I can't equate myself with the apostle, but I will say it's with a similar heart. I won't say the same heart, but I will say it's with the similar heart that I come to you this morning, hoping that you will hear what I believe God would have me bring for you to hear. Well, what is it that is such a concern to Peter that he needs to sneak this in at the close of his letter before he puts his pen down? In verse 2, he says to the elders of these fellowships, shepherd the flock of God which is among you, serving as overseers, not by compulsion. Don't do it because you feel like you have to. Don't ever let ministry start to feel like a trap. Don't let it get that bad. Always see to it you serve willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, not as being lords over those entrusted to you, but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd appears, because all elders are nothing more than under shepherds, or as Tim often says, sheepdogs, you'll receive the crown of glory that doesn't fade away. Likewise, you younger people. I don't think Peter's being snide here. You younger people. It means young in the faith, younger in the faith than those who have been walking this path as long as the elders of that church have. He says, submit yourselves to your elders. All of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility, because God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God that he may exalt you in due time. In due time. So what's Peter's big concern here? I hope that you're able to put the pieces together here. It seems to be that his concern is the quality of the relationship between the pastors and the members. Is that a stretch? That after what he said to the pastors in verses 1 through 4, coupled with what he says to the people in the following two verses, that Peter seems to have just a bit of concern about the relationship they have one between the other. For all of these churches, not just one isolated church, but these are regions filled with churches in and of themselves. And I want you to notice in what we just read here that everything he says to the shepherds is said for the good of the sheep. Okay? He says, don't do it by compulsion, but willingly, not for dishonest gain, but eagerly, not as being lords over those entrusted to you. He's got the sheep, the flock in mind as he gives this admonishment, this exhortation to the shepherds. And if you notice that everything he says to the sheep is for the good of the shepherds. He has the shepherds in mind when he tells the people to submit themselves to them. So why is it so important? that pastors have good relationships with their people and that people have good relationships with their pastor. Here's the reason. Basic survival. That good enough? I could end there. Basic survival. If you hope to make it, you must pay attention to this issue like Peter is. Where am I getting this idea of basic survival? Peter says in verse 8, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. You resist him, steadfast in the faith. Why? Because you know that the same sufferings are experienced by every Christian. Every church all over the world. This is nothing new. This is classic stuff. So guard the relationship that you have with your pastor. Nurture the relationship that's between you, because apparently the devil wants to exploit those things. And I and we both have seen this over and over and over. Guard your relationships. It's basic survival. And that's what we all want, isn't it? To survive. We all want to make it through this. I believe that when God gives his Holy Spirit to a born again Christian, that with it he implants within them a strong desire to finish well. If you're a Christian, I believe you have that desire. Nobody got involved here to not make it to the end. Okay? And nobody wants to be the next casualty in this fellowship. Right? If you do, raise your hand. Okay? No one? I don't think so. We all want to survive. Right? How many of you in here, by show of hands, want the first words you hear out of the mouth of Jesus Christ to be, well done, good and faithful servant? You can go ahead and raise your hand. Yeah. You want this more than anything. You just want to finish well. You want to survive. And the devil is pictured as a lion seeking to eat whoever's next available. And apparently, in Peter's estimation, it has something to do with the relationships between the leaders and the laity, the shepherds and the sheep, the clergy, if you will, and the congregation. Yeah? That's why he wants the church to survive here, as we all do, and he's telling us that our survival has a lot to do with giving proper attention to the relationship that pastors have with their people and that people have with their pastors. Please pay attention to the quality of that relationship as it fluctuates during times of testing, okay? I'll say it again. Be careful of the quality of the relationship, particularly that the people in this church have with the pastors in this church, as it fluctuates during time of testing and attack. Persecution, difficulty, because he will do his best to get between you and them. The devil has long understood that if he can strike the shepherd, he can scatter the sheep, and that if he can scatter the sheep, he's got another easy meal. He's been doing it from the beginning. That's why Peter says to the pastors, don't serve out of compulsion. Don't serve because you feel like you have to. Don't serve because it's forced upon you. And Peter doesn't want that to happen, because the more a pastor feels forced to shepherd the flock of God, and I can speak as a pastor here, the more you feel forced to do what you're to do for the Lord, the less love and care you have to give to the flock you've been entrusted with. And that's not good for the sheep, and Peter knows that very well. In 2 Samuel chapter 23, David says, when a leader rules over the people in righteousness, he's like the light of morning at sunrise on a cloudless morning, like the brightness after rain that brings grass from the earth. Apparently, it's a healthy leader. In our context this morning, it's a healthy pastor that will bring health to the flock. This is also why Peter says to the pastors, don't serve for dishonest gain, as many do. They get into the ministry for something that they think they can acquire through the ministry, sometimes money, not here, but elsewhere, I suppose. Sometimes glory and recognition, position, what have you. Peter says, make sure that that's not your motive. And the reason is because once a pastor no longer gains anything from that ministry, guess what's going to happen? He's going to abandon that ministry and abandon that flock and move on to a different one or something else altogether. And what do you suppose is going to happen to a flock when their shepherd abandons them during a lion attack? Any guesses? Urban theater, you could shout it out. They die. Were you on that trail? Yeah. They're going to be eaten alive. The devil knows that. So does Peter. The devil's going to attempt it. Peter's trying to prevent it. Jesus says in John 10, a guy like that won't lay his life down for the sheep because they don't really own the sheep. That's why when they see the wolf coming, they leave the sheep and run. He cares nothing for the sheep. Jesus says, a good shepherd like me wouldn't do that. I'll lay down my life. I care for the sheep. I'm not in it for the glory. I'm not in it for the accolades. If he was, he didn't get much, did he? So listen, when shepherds abide by the principles in verses 2 and 3, they're actually protecting their flock from the devil. We understand that. That when a shepherd does his job and does it well, he's actually safeguarding the sheep from the attacks of the lion. That's kind of his job, and we understand. But get this. When the sheep abide by the principles in verses 5 and 6, they're protecting their pastors from the devil. You're like, wait a second, sheep can protect their shepherds? Well, maybe not in the analogy, but in the context of church, you better believe it. You have a very significant role to play in the ongoing health and longevity of those who have been called to lead you. That's why Peter says to the people, submit yourselves to your elders. He's not doing it because he just wants to make your life miserable. He's doing it because the more rebellious a flock gets, the more their shepherd feels the need to start lording over them, which is the very opposite of what they ought to be doing. I believe that there is much of a pastor's likability that is contingent upon the conduct of their sheep. That's why Peter says to the people, humble yourselves. Humble yourselves, guys. Because why? Because the more pride a flock has inside of them, the less joy their shepherd feels in leading them. And again, I don't want to assume anything down here, but I will tell you, personally speaking, that when I see pride rear up in the people I'm called to lead, it makes my job miserable. Because now, what do I have a fight on my hands? Are we not going to do this anymore? How long will this contention last? How long will there be strife in our fellowship? How long will you continue being a spot in the love feasts that we're trying to have? It's fun for no one. Hebrews 13:17 says, obey those who rule over you and be submissive, for they watch out for your souls. Let them do so with joy, not with grief. The writer says, that wouldn't be profitable for you. So we understand that the performance of a pastor has everything to do with the quality of the health in the sheep, but we also see it working in reverse. A healthy pastor preserves the life of his flock just as much as a healthy sheep preserves the life of their pastor. I think a lot of people are aware of the fact that a shepherd has the ability to wound and seriously injure a sheep. But few people in the church realize that they have a reciprocated ability to wound or seriously injure their shepherd. And I guess I have no problem coming down here and sharing this because maybe there's some things that a pastor isn't comfortable sharing with his own flock. I haven't preached this in Duluth, and I don't know that I will. But I think that we need to see, at least I hope we understand, that this is the devil's playing field. often. And that if we can be aware of what's going on and see it for what it is, like Peter does in verses 8 and 9, then we can do a better job in verses 5 and 6. There's a lot at stake here. There's a lot at stake. So now that we've looking at the text that we have, I want to fill you in on the context of this passage. Peter's writing this letter under a certain context, and these people were living under conditions that were unique to the first century, just like we're living in conditions and situations that are unique in the 21st century. It's widely understood that the letter before you and I this morning was written just before or at the very beginning of some of Christian history's worst persecution. You have heard the name Caesar Nero, no doubt, if you've been in the church for any length of time. He had recently become emperor of Rome, taking the throne in 54 AD. This letter was written in the early 60s. But by the time this letter was written, suspicions had already been mounting against Christians. And the reason was because Christians are odd, weird, in the eyes of the world, both now and then. Apparently, these Christians, it was rumored, were holding private ceremonies of communion, where the supposed body and blood of a guy named Jesus were being consumed. Well, that's all they knew. And so rumors of cannibalism were spreading throughout that area. You add to that the growing irritation that was felt on behalf of these unbelieving communities for the Christians refusing to go along with their idolatry, which was normative in Roman culture. And so in their eyes, believers were the ones that were responsible for insulting the Roman gods by refusing to sacrifice to them. And any repercussions for refusing to sacrifice to those gods were being felt by everybody. And whose fault do you think that is? For failing to appease the gods. So everywhere you turned, Christians were upsetting social harmony. They were endangering the stability of the empire. They were really starting to annoy the world. Some things never change. And so by the time Peter writes this letter, hostility was already brewing in the hearts of a lot of people, but they didn't yet have permission to attack the Christians. And so they were forced for many years to suppress that growing hatred, bottle it up, and wait for an opportunity to give full vent to it. And that opportunity came on July 18th, 64 AD, just after or at the time of the writing of Peter's letter. It was on July 18th, 64 AD, that Nero allegedly lit fire to the city of Rome for personal and political reasons. That fire became one of the most devastating fires the world has ever known because it burnt to the ground approximately 3/4 of the capital city of one of the largest empires in human history. Very significant. Nero quickly became the target of suspicion as to the cause of the fires. He already had garnered a reputation for himself, and people wouldn't put it past him to have done this thing to his own kingdom. So, to divert attention from the rumors, he quickly and conveniently shifted the blame onto a growing religious sect called Christianity. He ordered that they should be gathered and killed, which was, lo and behold, the very permission that everyone had long been waiting for. Kill those neighbors we hate. kill those co-workers we hate. So needless to say, persecution grew and became extremely violent. Christians were sewn into animal skins and then set before wild dogs to be chewed apart. You probably know some of this stuff. They were dressed in clothes stiffened with wax and then dipped in pitch, strapped to poles, lit on fire to illuminate the dark. A lot of Christians understandably thought Nero was the Antichrist. He wasn't, but boy, he came close, didn't he? So these churches, these small little fellowships scattered about various regions in Asia Minor, these little churches were about to face a crisis like never before. And Peter somehow knew it. We gather that in chapter 4, verse 12. Peter says, "Beloved, don't think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is about to try you, as though some strange thing were happening." It's coming. And if relationships weren't hard enough to maintain on their own, a crisis can only make it worse. It's true. The devil doesn't need a crisis situation in order to do his best work in the church, but boy, it helps. So if one comes down the pike, he's going to take full advantage of it, I promise you. Now, interestingly, in neither of Peter's letters does Nero's name ever come up. Peter doesn't need to talk about the crisis. He doesn't mention Rome being lit on fire or Christians being lit up like torches or being sewn in animal skins. Because I don't think that Peter's so much worried about how they're dealing with Nero. He's worried about how they're dealing with each other. He's not as interested in seeing the people of this church survive the persecution as he is in seeing their relationships survive under the pressure. You take a read through 1 Peter. He's concerned about the quality of their marriage. That's why he wrote chapter 3. He's concerned about the witness that these Christians have at work. That's why he wrote chapter 2. Chapter 5 is here because he's concerned about the relationships that they have with one another within the church. Let me ask you a question. What do you suppose is God's greater concern for us right now in 2020? That we all survive the pandemic? Or that we actually like each other when it's over? That we're still here together worshiping when we can sing again? I can tell you what God's greater concern is. Not that we should go lax on abiding by the safety guidelines, thank you, CDC. But it's okay if you die. We all will sooner or later. What God is primarily interested in is the fellowship and the relationship that we maintain in spite of our situation, pandemic or not. There's nothing like a good crisis to distract us from the Great Commission, is there? And how easily we can let our eyes get on those things that surround us, and it feels like the world is on fire. It feels like everything's falling apart. And Peter now writes a letter to go, keep your eyes on what's important. Like, yes, escape Nero, all right? Don't go and be flippant about, you know, don't get yourself arrested if it's at all possible, okay? Keep your mask on and don't sneeze on people. But please, watch your marriage. Love your pastor. If these guys can't figure out how to love and to submit in humility, no matter what role they serve in the church, then they won't need Nero to kill the fellowship. It'll happen on its own. You notice at the end of verse 9, Peter says every church deals with this. That includes us, guys. For them it was Nero, for us it's COVID. But it hardly matters. The question this morning is, which crisis are you hoping to survive? We got our own. But we're actually in the midst of two right now. One of them makes world news. Others won't go any further than the church newsletter, so to speak. As far as I know, there isn't anybody in either church, yours or mine, that's died of the coronavirus yet. But how many, might I ask, are relationally sick right now? You're sick with strife. You have it in you. There are suspicions that you allow to roam around your mind unchecked. You're angry. Somebody's upset you. And how many are already gone, passed away? We'll never see them again. What does it say of us as Christians when we take every precaution we can so that we don't catch the virus, but we don't take many precautions at all to keep loving each other like we should? I'm reading from my notes, so this may come across like a sermon, but it's not. I'm just talking to you guys. This is survival. Basic survival. Nero's coming. I don't know if they knew it yet. I don't know if Peter understood it yet. But persecution was coming for each and every one of these little churches in Pontus and Galatia and Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia. Some of the Christians there, no doubt, might not survive it. Again, it was some of the worst Christian persecution in church history. Some of the pastors, no doubt, would lose their lives. But may I suggest that it wouldn't necessarily be on account of being strapped to poles and set on fire. When I say that some of them may not survive the crisis, I'm suggesting that it may have been on account of a breakdown in the quality of the relationship between them. And that's what Peter saw coming. And that's why he wrote chapter 5. And that's why he didn't feel the need to include Nero's name. A lot of these people would survive the persecution just fine. Just like many of us will survive this pandemic, but will we survive the real crisis? That's the question. The devil, the lion that he is well acquainted with Romans 8:38, and so are you. That's the one where it says that nothing, not height, nor depth, nor nothing on earth or in heavens or the unseen world, there's nothing at all, nothing anywhere ever that could separate us from the love of the great shepherd. The devil, the lion that he is, knows that he can't get between you and the great shepherd. If you're saved, you're saved. And so long ago, the devil turned his attention and focused a new strategy upon separating you from the love of your pastor. Because that's a relationship that he can get into. What would separate you from the love of your under shepherd? Would height or depth or length or breadth or pandemic or a bad day or an offensive, imaginarily crass email? Well, we don't know a whole lot about the people or the pastors and the fellowships that got this letter from the Apostle Peter, but we do know that he was concerned for those people and that he really wanted these guys to hear what he said. That's all he wanted. That they would hear what he had to say, guard themselves against what the devil has always tried to do, and take these things to heart.